Jews against the death penalty?
I certainly can do so. This is the traditional Jewish prayer for mourning, the El Malei Rachamim. And it will be in the Hebrew.
It looks like we lost the cantor. We'll do that another day. But I think we'll go out with Paul Robeson. This is Democracy Now!
Schlaf, mein Kind, schlaf gesegnet, singen will ich dir ein Lied, als du, mein Kind, wärst älter werden, wärst du wissen an Unterschied. Als du, mein Kind, wärst älter werden, wärst du wissen an Unterschied.
Schlaf, mein Kind, performed by Paul Robeson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Hate speech, racism, and lies soared on the website formerly known as Twitter after it was taken over by billionaire Elon Musk last year. That's according to the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Musk has responded to the findings by filing a lawsuit against the center over the research. Elon Musk recently changed the name of Twitter to the letter X, accuses the British watchdog group of unlawfully accessing data to, quote, falsely claim it had statistical support showing the platform is overwhelmed with harmful content. Twitter gives its Twitter Blue subscribers who pay to use the platform prioritize rankings and conversations in search. The Center for Countering Digital Hate looked at 100 different paid Twitter Blue accounts and found the company failed to act on 99% of hate posts they made. This comes as Musk has laid off about 80% of the X workforce, including a large number of content moderators, and shut down its Trust and Safety Council. Meanwhile, Musk, who calls himself a free speech absolutist, has reinstated the accounts of numerous white supremacists, bigots, and conspiracy theorists. Last week, he reinstated rapper Kanye West, now known as Ye, who was removed for a series of anti-Semitic rants. For more, we're joined by two guests. Nora Benavides is senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press. And Imran Ahmed is CEO for the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which Musk is suing. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for being with us. Imran, we're going to begin with you, as Musk is suing you. Can you explain what you found and then your response to the lawsuit?
Well, thank you for having me on. And just to clarify, we're not a British watchdog. We're a U.S. 501c3 headquartered in Washington, D.C. We do have a British office as well, and clearly I'm British. The work that we've done since the takeover by Elon Musk is to look at what happened when he took over. So what were the changes in the scale of hate and disinformation on his platform, and also their moderation of that hate and disinformation? All platforms have community standards. The question is that those standards, which are our responsibilities as users, and also, therefore, a reciprocal right that we expect others to abide by them as well, and for the platform to enforce those rules, how effectively are they being enforced? Our first piece of work that you mentioned there was one that looked at the increase in the use of hate speech on that platform, so specifically at racial slurs. And what we found is a substantial increase in the use of hate speech on that platform in the weeks and months following Mr. Musk's takeover. There's other research that we've done to test their moderation capabilities. What we've done is we've literally gone out and asked, we've reported hate on the platform, extreme hate, like you know, the sort of stuff saying, go out and shoot gay people, or the kind of, you know, really, really appalling and abominable anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that were being, that you were just referencing in the most recent package that you had on. And then we went back and we audited what action they took. Now, with Twitter blue users, 99 times out of 100, they took no action on extreme hate. And why? Because, I mean, you know, one can theorize very simply that that's because for these $100 a year accounts, these $8 a month accounts, that they're simply not willing to enforce the rules on them for fear of losing that revenue stream. It just shows that under Mr. Musk, the platform has become a more toxic, it's got more disinformation, more hatred on there. And 9 months after our initial piece of research, he sued us about it.
Hmm. And Imran, I want to ask you about the piece that you wrote for MSNBC, headlined X Misses the Mark in Threatening to Sue My Group for Documenting Online Hate Speech. In the article, you speak specifically about the case of the artist formerly known as Kanye West, who now goes by Ye, I guess, Y-E. He'd been taken off the platform, but has since very recently returned. Explain why he was deplatformed and then why he's returned.
Well, he was deplatformed for extreme anti-Semitic content that he posted. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of coverage about his particular opinions on Jewish people and his praise for Hitler, etc. But why he was let back on is part of a wave of the replatforming of giving back accounts to people who'd been kicked off by either the old administration or the current administration, which, of course, does enforce its rules sometimes. Because, frankly, controversy, you know, drives attention. I mean, Musk has said many times that Twitter will survive if it's if people are paying attention to what's happening on there. And the best way to do that is stuff that really raises our ire, in his view. So things, hate, disinformation, stuff that makes us go, that's unacceptable, get into arguments with people, go back and check whether or not people agree with us or someone else. Really, he's looking for eyeballs. And he's willing to use extreme controversy, even that the algorithms, of course, funnel the fringes, funnel the most controversial content, the most engaged with content, into more timelines. So he's turning it into a sort of a non-stop car crash with the hope of getting eyeballs so he can place ads on those on that content. And that is really the business model. It's incredibly cynical. The problem for him is advertisers don't want their content next to that. And he's lost tens of millions of dollars as a result. Now, that's what he's put in his lawsuit against us. And he's blaming us directly for having caused the loss of those hundreds of millions of dollars, those tens of millions of dollars, because we documented the hate on the platform. You know, my contention is all we do is hold up a mirror to Mr. Musk and say, do you like the reflection you see in there? And rather than do what anyone responsible would do, which is say, there's a problem, I need to fix that, this is mine, he said, I'm going to sue the mirror.
Well, Imran, I mean, you've said, of course, and he has, Musk and Twitter have lost tens of millions of dollars since he took charge. But despite that, or maybe because of it, Musk says that he wants to change, expand the platform, now called X, into an everyday app akin to China's WeChat, which includes not just messaging, but also, or posting, but also messaging, payments, videos, and other forms of media and exchange. If you could comment on that.
You know, if Mr. Musk has plans to expand his business, I wish him I wish him all luck with it. I have no problem with him making money. I have no problem with people doing business. What I have a problem with is that when there is hate and disinformation being algorithmically amplified into billions of timelines, it's perfectly right that people that oppose the spread, the production and distribution of hate, seek to research it and seek to put that out into the public sphere. That is, after all, our First Amendment right to do so. And Mr. Musk's attempt to strategically litigate to stop us from publicly participating, so a slap suit, you know, that is really it's incredibly cynical coming from someone who purports to be very pro-speech, and to do so by going after civil society. Look, you've got Nora on as well, who's a friend, and our organizations and many others do research on these platforms, do advocate for better experiences for users on those platforms with less hate and disinformation. And of course, because of the huge human rights and civil rights implications of the spread of hate and disinformation, I don't want to make the obvious connection to what we saw in Pittsburgh or what we saw in Colorado Springs, but there is a very strong public interest reason to expose what happens on these platforms. And it is vital, therefore, that CCDH resists this lawsuit. He's trying to crush a small organization. I mean, he's the world's richest man. We are an organization that's relatively small. We're a 501c3. We rely entirely on public donations. And we're going to have to make sure that we don't allow this litigation to succeed, because if it does, it will have a broader chilling effect across anyone who wants to comment on the businesses Mr. Musk runs.
So Elon Musk calls you a rat, Imran Ahmed, and calls your organization evil. You have a powerful lawyer representing you in Robbie Kaplan, who represents E. Jean Carroll. Are you getting increased death threats? Is your organization being threatened?
I mean, if death threats came into the organization, I wouldn't get to see any against me. But I know that, you know, we are perfectly aware that I have a responsibility to my 20 staff who I care about, who are intelligent, brilliant advocates for our cause. And we do everything that we need to do to make sure that our staff are safe psychologically and physically. What I will say to you is that when a man like that calls you a rat, you know, he knows the language he uses. I mean, he may not be a stable genius, but he is a clever man. And he knows what he's doing when he calls someone evil and a rat. And I'll tell you something. You know, we've pushed back against that. The amazing thing for me, and I'm not someone that is particularly needy of praise or affirmation, but so many people, you know, from the actor Mark Ruffalo through to all of our colleagues in civil society through to politicians, have stood up and said, absolutely, this is outrageous. Because this is a group that set up, I set it up because my colleague Jo Cox MP, a 35-year-old mother of two, was assassinated by a far-right terrorist who believed in the Great Replacement Theory in Britain 7 years ago. And I knew that social media and the way that social media platforms were allowing and accelerating the distribution of conspiracy theories that led to my colleague's death, you know, had a responsibility. And I wanted to make sure that they recognized that responsibility. I think the irony of this entire situation is that in an attempt to shut down transparency in his platform and accountability, what Mr. Musk has done is created a unimpeachable case and a cacophony of support for federal transparency and accountability legislation in the United States. It's unacceptable that in the European Union, with the Digital Services Act, in the United Kingdom, with the Online Services Bill, that there is absolutely nothing in the US to ensure that researchers have access to information on these platforms that we know have, you know, massive impact on individual psychology. We do a lot of work on the impact on kids as well. It's bad, you know, and on our democracy. It's unacceptable that they can operate in such a opaque and unaccountable way. And of course, I think that by winning this case and by defending this case vigorously, we will create that broader case for federal transparency and accountability legislation.
I want to bring Nora Benavides into this conversation and to talk about Twitter, now known as X, internationally. Can you talk about its record in censoring ethnic minorities in India and dissidents in Turkey, working with China to censor critics? Elon Musk claims that Twitter's predecessors did the same thing. Is that true?
Sure. Well, Amy, it's wonderful to be here with you, and it's wonderful to be here with Imran as well, hearing this story and working closely with the center. It's been an incredible journey watching, and I think the only response when we get attacked by bullies is to stand up and to come together. So I look at this long track record that Elon Musk has when it comes to silencing critics. That's his go-to tactic to evade accountability. He has done that over and over over again. He did it even before he took over Twitter. Back when he was running Tesla, he had a long track record of silencing people. He fired employees who spoke about malfunctions with their cars. He colluded with and partnered with the Chinese government to make sure that any malfunctions at all on listservs would be minimized. And that kind of bad behavior, that silencing of critics, has transferred to Twitter or X. And now we've really seen 8 or so months of just a long track record of Elon Musk going after anyone who tries to be critical of something he doesn't like. And so, as you say, he has a global track record of this. There was a BBC documentary which explored the targeting by the Indian government of the Muslim minority population. And what he did was he systematically worked with the Modi government to make sure that posts about that BBC documentary that supported it, that applauded the kind of attention that needed to come to that issue in India, was suppressed, minimized, and downgraded on the platform. He has other examples, of course, where he sort of cherry-picks content. When he doesn't like what someone is saying, he uses the biggest platform in the world to make sure that people don't see it. He removes journalists when he doesn't like what they are saying or the way that they are covering him. He makes sure that competition with Twitter is also minimized. This is sort of a, as Imran said, a cacophony. And the chaos that Elon Musk has created means that it's hard for us to track it unless we have the researchers in place, the kinds of tools and the transparency that shine a light on what's really happening in a company that Elon Musk has done everything to hide from us, to evade accountability.
Nora Benavides, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights at Free Press, and Imran Ahmed, CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Next up, we're going to Colorado. The ACLU there has sued the FBI and the Colorado Springs Police Department for illegally spying on a local activist and infiltrating a community organizing hub. We'll speak to that activist and find out what happened. Stay with us.
Shachnam ben Menachem Mendel, v'et Daniel Avraham ben Baruch, v'et Moshe Gadol ben Yosef, v'et Yitzchak Chaim ben Menachem, v'et Yehuda ben Yechezkel v'Selma, v'et Idit Baltecha bat Abba Menachem.
That's our first guest on Democracy Now! Today, Cantor Michael Zusman's reciting the traditional Jewish memorial prayer for the 11 Tree of Life victims in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado has sued the FBI, the Colorado Springs Police Department, and local officers for illegally spying on a local activist in a community organizing hub in Colorado Springs. The lawsuit accuses the agencies of, quote, unconstitutional and invasive search and seizure of the phones, computers, devices, and private chats of people and groups whose message the Colorado Springs Police Department dislikes, unquote. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of a local activist and the Chinook Center. Center, a community organizing hub in Colorado Springs. This comes after revelations the FBI had infiltrated the Chinook Center by sending an undercover police detective named April Rogers to volunteer there in 2020. This was part of a broader FBI effort to infiltrate racial justice and left-leaning groups in Colorado after the police killing of George Floyd. The FBI's role in infiltrating protest movements in Colorado was first exposed by the investigative reporter Trevor Aronson, who writes for The Intercept and created the Alphabet Boys podcast. In this clip, Aronson describes what happened when April Rogers was forced to testify in another case.
Charles Johnson's lawyer is named Allison Blackwell. She believes the charges against her client are politically motivated. So, during a hearing, she calls April Rogers as a witness, over the objections of prosecutors who do not want the undercover cop to testify. For the hearing, a lawyer representing the U.S. Department of Justice is sitting at the prosecution's table.
When you were marching in the housing march, were you doing that for the Colorado Springs Police Department?
I was under the authority of the FBI.
Okay. How many other FBI agents were in that march?
I respectfully decline to answer.
Does the Colorado Springs Police Department know that you're working for the FBI?
Yes.
So I want to talk about going back to the Chinook Center. Did you feel guilty about that?
I respectfully decline to answer.
April is wearing a black dress with a black face mask to protect her undercover identity. She has long, dark brown hair, but it looks like a wig. A good one, but a wig all the same. On request, while on the witness stand, April pulls down her face mask, but only to her chin. Attorney Allison Blackwell asks April question after question. And nearly every time April answers, I respectfully decline to answer. She keeps looking over at the lawyer from the Justice Department. It's a truly bizarre scene, one of the strangest I've ever witnessed in a courtroom. This is a state courthouse. And in this case, the United States government is not a party. And yet, a Justice Department lawyer is instructing a local cop not to answer questions about a criminal case she helped investigate.
That's an excerpt from the podcast The Alphabet Boys about how the FBI infiltrated activist groups in Colorado Springs. We're joined now by two guests, Jacqueline Armendariz Anzueta, known as Jax. She's in Colorado Springs, a community organizer who's a plaintiff in the new ACLU Colorado lawsuit. Also with us, the award-winning investigative journalist Trevor Aronson, contributing writer to The Intercept and the creator of the Alphabet Boys podcast. His new article's headline, Lawsuit Targets FBI Probe of Racial Justice Activists. He's the author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Trevor, lay out more fully this case. This undercover cop who was working for the FBI, known to the group in Chinook as, her name was, they called her Chelsea. She had pink hair. She implied she was a sex worker. Take it from there.
Yeah, so the FBI recruited April Rogers, a Colorado Springs detective, to infiltrate the Chinook Center. And she went in as a volunteer. She claimed to be a sex worker. And she was given tasks, administrative tasks in the organization. And for more than a year, she was undercover for the FBI, gathering information about members of the Chinook Center, its activities, and then providing that back to the Colorado Springs Police Department and the FBI. She was also attempting unsuccessfully to entrap activists in gun-running conspiracies that the FBI was trying to engineer. And her role appeared to be twofold. One, a blanket surveillance, that she was collecting information about activists. And two, that she was trying to entrap some of these activists in crimes, ultimately unsuccessful in the latter effort. But if for more than a year, she was undercover gathering information.
And this
and so
was
the,
what year?
The search warrant. This started in 2020, in the summer of 2020, and continued through the summer of 2021. So for more than a year, this was a significant time investment by both the FBI and the Colorado Springs Police Department in using an undercover in this capacity. And so the search warrants at question are part of this larger effort by the FBI to basically surveil and investigate the Chinook Center under essentially a domestic terrorism investigation.
So, Jacqueline, you're one of the plaintiffs in this case. Could you talk about when you found out that there was this FBI informant and what the consequences for you personally have been?
Thank you. Yes, that's right. Good morning from Colorado Springs. So, you know, this was one of the worst moments of my life. And I only found out the extent of this violation of our constitutional rights when I realized, you know, I demanded to see the search warrant for my home when they came and acted if I was some sort of criminal. Then I realized that this was some sort of effort that involved, you know, the Joint Terrorism Task Force with CSPD and as I mentioned, I'd never been arrested before in my life. I happened to be at the housing march that day because I was actually at the time a U.S. Senate staffer, and we were working on a particular project with the housing crisis. So I came to participate because I believe housing is a human right, and I came to observe, do my job, understand what the local community was saying. And I can tell you that I've never been the same since the CSPD decided to violate my constitutional rights, invade my privacy. And let's not forget the real part of this story is that CSPD was targeting and retaliating against us. They sent me a very clear message to shut down, sit up, little girl, know your place. They criminalized our speech, which is that Black Lives Matter, housing is a human right, white supremacy is domestic terrorism, and they tried to use that as a basis to criminalize us. And I would just add that really this behavior from CSPD stems as far back as 2019, because today is the four-year remembrance of the killing of Devon Bailey, who a CSPD officer shot as he ran away. They shot him in the back and killed him. And our community started organizing to demand accountability from CSPD. And ever since then, we've been a target for CSPD. And this case clearly shows that.
So, Jax, can you tell us about what happened to your personal devices, your personal data? How did the authorities take them?
Absolutely. So they came to my home to arrest me for a false accusation involving my participation in the march. And I demanded that they show me the search warrant. And it was a warrant for all my electronic devices. This included, you know, personal devices, my work devices, which at the time were the property of the U.S. Senate. And this included devices that, you know, I hadn't used in years, an external hard drive from my middle school, high school days that had nothing but MP3s. So it was incredibly invasive, so much personal content, you know, content from another litigation that I was involved
in. And, Jax, we only have 30 seconds, and then we're going to do a post show and put it online at democracynow.org. But when did you realize that Chelsea, the so-called activist, had joined your group, was actually an undercover police officer working for the FBI?
Well, that's the funny thing. It was only through my court case that we had that kind of break in information, because I refused to plead guilty to the crime of which I was accused. And as a result, the discovery revealed from the body cam of the officers talking amongst themselves that there were multiple undercover officers who had infiltrated us. And so I shared that with my co-defendants, my fellow organizers, and that was a huge break in the case for our understanding of just how thoroughly our constitutional rights had been violated.
Well, we're going to continue with part two of this discussion and post it at democracynow.org. We want to thank Jacqueline Armendariz-Enzueta, a Colorado Springs community organizer, a plaintiff in the new ACLU of Colorado lawsuit, and Trevor Aronson. We'll continue with you as well. Award-winning investigative journalist will link to your new piece for The Intercept, Lawsuit Targets FBI Probe of Racial Justice Activists. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Polygon Gallery presents the North American premiere of Jeremy Shaw's latest and largest production to date, Phase Shifting Index, until September 24th, 2023. Employing various outmoded 20th century media, Shaw presents what appears to be documentary footage as the distant future, creating cognitive dissonance within the viewer's relation to a sense of place and time. To learn more about this event, visit thepolygon.ca.